is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight, authorities in Burkina Faso are investigating an explosion at a gold mine site which killed at least 59 people. And the Libyan parliament selects a former interior minister to head the government, a move that has left the country with two prime ministers. These stories and more on African News Tonight. But first, our top story. Ethiopia began producing electricity on Sunday from its Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, GERD, on the River Nile that neighbors Sudan and Egypt have worried will cause water shortages downstream. Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed officially inaugurated the partial commencement of power generation of GERD and said, Ethiopia does not want to harm anyone. The country's goal is to use the power for its large population that has never seen electricity and to alleviate poverty, and called for cooperation, not confrontation, over the Nile water. Ambassador Mohamed Higazi, former assistant Egyptian foreign minister, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi the statement of Ethiopian Prime Minister and Egyptian affirmation that this move is a violation of the 2015 Declaration of Principles Agreement.
If he's sincere about cooperation, not confrontation, then the best way or the entry to any regional cooperation should be based on a legal framework. This is the way all international rivers should be conducted towards the integration of their resources. The riparian countries should agree legally of developing an integrated plan of action that will guarantee to Ethiopia its right of power generation and without harming both Sudan and Egypt. And this is exactly what we have agreed in the Declaration of Principles signed between the leaders of the three countries in Khartoum on the 23rd of March 2015. If you look at Article 5 that said that the three Riparians should cooperate in the first filling and in the operation of the dam, Ethiopia, in full violation of that, started the first filling, the second filling, and now the inauguration of the first two power generation units. It means that it is in complete violation of what it has been agreed upon. How can you talk about cooperation while you are in violation of what you have signed? I am talking about the first article, the principle of cooperation. They are in full violation. They have breached what they have assigned and signed. The second, the regional cooperation and sustainability. Where is it? When you are unilaterally on the third step of violating, and maybe later on you will go into your unilateral act.
Egypt affirms that this step is a further move by the Ethiopian side in violating its obligations under the 2015 Declaration of Principles Agreement signed by the Ethiopian Prime Minister. Can you explain how generating electricity from the Ethiopian dam is violating several principles of that declaration?
They are in full direction of threatening the neighboring countries in a very sensitive and strategic region. The equitable and just use of water, how about the two down reaches? When you think that an international river is yours, this is another violation of Article number 4. Number 5, it is about consultation and cooperation in regards to the first filling and in the operation of the Renaissance Dam. Where is it? The 6 is the principle of confidence building. From where the confidence will come? When one party is trying to work for its own development without looking at the interests of the downreaches. The 7th is the exchange of information and data. Where is the fulfillment of the recommendation of the international expert panel who have requested Ethiopia to run studies for the well-being and security of this huge building? The 9th is the principle of sovereignty and the unity of the region. Can you tell me, with all those practices, where can we talk about unity, cooperation, and the question of sovereignty when one part of the Nile is threatening the other two parts? The wisdom is to develop Africa for the benefit of its people, and the question of development does not mean that you develop yourself on the expense of the others. What we are requiring is that whatever is related to development and power generation and the running of such a huge, massive building on a river that is shared by other parties, that you should agree on a legal, just framework. The Renaissance Dam is followed by one small dam in Sudan, which is the Roseiras. The first, which is the Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, carries 65 billion cubic meters, while the Roseiras Dam in Sudan carries only 7 billion cubic meters. Without coordination, how can you run the 60 billion cubic meters in the future without consultation and coordination and a legal binding framework between the parties? So this is, from a geographical point of view, is also another threat to two countries, particularly Egypt, lives in an arid zone, all desert but the Nile. It's the livelihood of 120 million people. So we cannot really take the argument of the Prime Minister of Ethiopia saying that he's saying that it is about development and power generation. If it is like that, we are more than happy to include all your requirements in an agreed upon document that can run the river to the benefit of all in the region.
That was Ambassador Mohammed Higazi, former Assistant Egyptian Foreign Minister, speaking with VOA Senior Analyst Mohammed Al-Shenawi. Ethiopia's government considers the electricity from the dam essential to its economic development. When power generation began on Sunday, Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed said the dam would not affect the downstream flow of the river. He said the goal is not to harm any other nations, but to provide electricity to millions who do not have access to it. He also said Ethiopia would export electricity from the dam to Egypt and Sudan. For now, only one of the dam's 13 turbines is currently operational, with a capacity of 375 megawatts. The $4.2 billion project ultimately should generate more than 5,000 megawatts of electricity, more than double Ethiopia's electricity output. Egypt and Sudan pushed Ethiopia from a binding deal over the filling and operation of the dam. And in 2015, the three countries issued a declaration of principles, but subsequent talks failed to reach an agreement. As a result, both Khartoum and Cairo have condemned the filling of the dam. Authorities in Burkina Faso are investigating an explosion at a gold mine site, which killed at least 50 people, according to reports by state broadcaster RTB and witnesses. Monday's blast injured at least 100 other people in the southwest village of Gibomblora. The explosion was believed to have been caused by chemicals used to treat gold that were stocked at the site. Mining experts say the small-scale mines have fewer regulations than industrial ones and thus can be more dangerous. Burkina Faso is the fastest-growing gold producer in Africa and currently the fifth largest on the continent, with gold being the country's most important export. The House of Representatives in Libya approved former Interior Minister Fatih Bassaga to head the government, a move that left the government with two prime ministers. The UN said on Friday that Secretary General Antonio Guterres has taken note of the move by Parliament to appoint Bassaga and a move by Parliament and the High State Council to chart a revised path to elections. The incumbent, Abdulhamid Dabiba, has said he does not recognize Parliament's attempt to remove him and that he will not step down. In an exclusive interview for VOA, Global Affairs analyst Ahmed Fatih discussed the power struggle in Libya with the UN Secretary General's special advisor in Libya, Stephanie Williams.
what's happened and what the Secretary General in his statement of last week took note of is the fact that the parliament, in consultation with the High Council of State in Libya, had a vote to designate a prime minister, Mr. Bashagha. So we have prime minister designate, and then there's the incumbent prime minister. The prime minister designate has been tasked by the parliament to form a government and to present that government for a vote in the House of Representatives. Our strong counsel and all of my interactions with, you know, all of the Libyan parties have been focused on the need to maintain calm during this process, to allow a political process to occur between Libyan actors. And the first thing that the international community has said in all of its statements concerning Libya is that the international community respects a Libyan-owned and a Libyan-led process. And that's what we have. We have the two internationally recognized institutions, the legislature in the form of the House of Representatives and the advisory assembly, the High Council of State, having agreed a series of measures. What Libyans don't want, quite clearly, is a return to any form of violence. That has been made clear to me in all of my visits and consultations across Libya, from Tripoli to Qubba in the east to Sebha, the capital of the south. It's been 11 years, and Libyans are exhausted of conflict and division. They want unified institutions, and they want a clear path forward with, you know, a constitutional framework and clear, credible electoral laws that can lead to free and fair elections in Libya.
The Prime Minister designate, Mr. Bashagha, flew into Tripoli on Thursday night ahead of a two-week government formation process. And he said he expected the current Prime Minister, Dibeba, to hand over power peacefully. But Dibeba said he will announce his own roadmap for the country involving elections this summer. What is the way out to have one unified Libyan government?
Well, look, Libyans don't, as I said, Libyans don't want divided institutions. Libyans want their political actors, the political leaders, to engage in a responsible discourse. And this is one thing that has changed since I first came to Libya during a period of conflict. And certainly I witnessed a direct conflict in the capital between 2019 and 2020. And what we have now is a transformation from a discourse of conflict to a discourse of politics. And that's very good. And Libyans need to work through their political conflicts peacefully. And that's what I'm here for. I'm here, I'm in Libya to work with Libyans to peacefully move the country forward. We saw a peaceful transition of power last year, in March of 2021, when the same parliament granted confidence in the government of Mr. Dibeba, who was selected through a UN-facilitated process. What you had at that point was you had the previous prime minister, Mr. Sarraj, peacefully hand over power to the new prime minister. And so I think that's a very good precedent that was set.
Prime Minister designate Fathi Bashagha and the current Prime Minister Dibeba, both are from Libya's third largest city, Misrata. And both candidates for the aborted presidential poll have the support of rival armed group in the western part of Libya. Would that facilitate or complicate reaching a compromise, since the tribal relations play a very important factor in a society like the Libyan society?
Well, you're absolutely right to note that Misrata is a very important city in Libya. What I'm pleased with is the fact that there is calm on the ground now, despite the fact there is significant political tension in the country. And we call on all actors to behave responsibly in the weeks and days going forward, that the use of force is absolutely unacceptable. The use of threats of force, intimidation of political actors is also unacceptable. All of the political actors, whether they're members of the two institutions or anyone else, you know, involved in the political scene in Libya, should be able to move and to make decisions without having the threat of use of force over them or any sort of intimidation. That's absolutely unacceptable.
That was the UN Secretary General's special advisor in Libya, Stephanie Williams, speaking with global affairs analyst Ahmed Fati. UN and international aid agencies are racing to minimize the impact of tropical storm Imnati, which is expected to hit eastern Madagascar early Tuesday evening, local time. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Emnati is the fourth powerful storm to strike Madagascar in as many weeks. It is likely to have a devastating effect on thousands of people who still are reeling from the impact of tropical cyclone Batsirai, which struck central Madagascar on February 5th. Batsirai affected an estimated 270,000 people. The United Nations reports 20,500 homes were destroyed, flooded, or damaged, rendering some 21,000 people homeless. The World Meteorological Organization predicts Emnati will produce destructive wind speeds of between 150 and 200 kilometers an hour. While this is dangerous, WMO spokeswoman Claire Nullis says one of the biggest threats is water, the heavy rainfalls that kill.
You know, there's a risk they'll cause bad flooding and landslides in the region. And as I said, this region has been hit by successive tropical storms. You know, it's flooded. It's the land is waterlogged. It can't absorb any more water. So, you know, any more rainfall at this stage is just, you know, one drop too many.
The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs previously had sent several disaster management experts to Madagascar to respond to Cyclone Batsirai. OCHA spokesman Jens Laerke says additional staff from the region is being deployed in the country in anticipation of Emnati.
We're in a race against time to protect those who dealt with the fury of the first three extreme weather events from the impact of Emnati. The response covers health consultations, distribution of cash and hot meals to displaced families, restoration of access to clean water, and provision of shelter items to support families to return home.
OCHA is providing $2.5 million from the UN Central Emergency Response Fund. The money will be used for food and cash assistance, emergency health care, shelter, and other essential relief. The World Food Program also has deployed additional teams to respond to Emnati. The agency says it is providing food rations to more than 3,500 people who have sought refuge ahead of the cyclone. WFP says information technology experts also have been deployed in the area for immediate intervention. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The leader of South Africa's third biggest political party has defended himself against allegations he is inciting violence against the country's white farmers. Civil rights group ARI Forum wants the Equality Court in Johannesburg to order economic freedom fighter, the EFF commander-in-chief, Julius Malema, to stop singing a song that suggests white farmers be shot. In 2010, when he was president of the African National Congress Youth League, Malema was found guilty of hate speech for singing a similar song called Kill the Farmer. Darren Taylor reports.
Since his conviction 11 years ago, Malema has adapted the lyrics of the song, but it still includes the words kill the man and shoot the boer. Boer is Afrikaans for farmer.
I was taught the song when I was very young. I joined the struggle when I was 9 years.
The EFF leader told the judge the song has its roots in the struggle against apartheid, sung at a time when township militants were teaching youngsters to oppose white supremacy.
Part of what they did to us, my lord, was to try and teach us struggle songs. They would give us some wooden guns to teach us how to hold a gun, how to shoot.
Malema says the Kill the Boer song was symbolic and written to inspire South Africans to destroy all forms of oppression and white superiority. In its latest form, he says, it's sung to encourage his black compatriots to fight for their land, which he says remains in the hands of white capitalists. AfriForum points out that the government is by far the biggest landowner in South Africa, not whites. It contends the song advocates hatred on the grounds of race and ethnicity and is an incitement to cause harm. In court, the organization's lawyer showed footage of Malema singing at several political rallies and protests in recent years, to which he reacted defiantly.
Not a single video shows me singing Kill the Boer, so I think they are looking for a wrong person.
but another film not shown in court shows him singing the Zulu words Dubul Ibunu, which means kill the farmer. AfriForum's lawyer called a witness, Gabriel Krauser, who testified he'd seen and heard another senior EFF official, Mbuyiseni Ndlozi, calling for violence against white farmers at a demonstration in 2020.
I was with the police, but right next to the crowd. I heard something that pricked my ear, and so I asked for a translation. What was explained to me was that MP Ndlozi was saying something to the effect of, call the fire brigade, we must set fire to farmers or boers or something to that effect.
AfriForum says several farms were attacked days after Ndlozi allegedly sang the song at the court appearance of suspects accused of murdering a white farmer. The group's lawyer called several survivors of farm attacks to give emotional testimony about their experiences. 75-year-old Duncan Prinsloo told how several young men shot him, leaving him paralyzed, then executed his wife. He said he believed the attackers had been inspired by the EFF songs. The party's advocate, Mfesane Kasiboto, then cross-examined Prinsloo.
I'm asking you, how do you know that your attackers were influenced by the song?
Well, I don't know.
No, of course you don't.
I presume.
Yes, of course you don't know.
Malema described South Africa as a crime scene anywhere. He said farm attacks are a drop in the ocean compared with what's happening in the country's black townships. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhim in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America.
Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports.